This is Business Impact, a podcast series from UCD College of Business, Ireland's leading business school. I'm your host, Emmett Oliver, and each episode I'll be joined by world-renowned faculty from across the College of Business, as well as international industry leaders who'll offer us insight, spark curiosity, and challenge you to rethink how you do business in a changing world. Now, you're welcome back to another edition of Business Impact, and we start with a bit of an apology. It's been a few weeks since our last episode, just various events, let's just call them euphemistically like that, have sort of interrupted our normal flow and regularity of podcasts, but here we are once again. Obviously, there's big global events that have got in the way out in the Middle East, and they've absorbed our time on other issues, and lots of people, of course, busy at this time of the year at UCD Business School, exams coming up, last few lectures in train. So it's generally kind of a fertile atmosphere, both students and staff at this time of the year, getting everything right and getting all our procedures in place as we see off the final year of graduates and head off into the summer months. But that still seems a bit away. Now, as I mentioned in that intro, we have had big geopolitical events out in Iran, and these are not just something to be looked at from a distance. They are filtering down into everyone's lives in terms of cost of fuel, cost of energy. And unfortunately, when the winter and autumn comes on this part of the world, they'll filter down into higher heating bills. But we just have to see what happens in that space. But my guest today is going to be able to help us with all of that, but other issues as well, because he is a veteran aviation expert and senior executive. He lectures here in UCD Business School on our various aviation programs, where he is an adjunct professor at UCD at our graduate business school. And that man is a man called Norman Liu. He is a really, really storied executive. He was at one point a CEO at GECAS, which is one of the world's largest aircraft lessors. He's also been in aviation finance in a number of other areas as well. He'll tell you a little bit more about that in a second. And of course, he's got a lot of experience in asset finance more generally and infrastructure in a whole range of areas. He graduated from Yale in 1979 and has an MBA from Harvard Business School from 1982 and is a 2017 Advanced Leadership Fellow at Harvard. So Norman has quite a lot. Norman, you're very welcome to the podcast.
Sure. Just call me Norm.
I'll call you Norm. Once you're going informal, I'm happy to do that as well. Listen, I've given a brief flavour of your career. Obviously, aviation finance and aircraft leasing at the heart of it, but you have a whole range of interests which you can tell us about in a few minutes. But just tell us about your lecturing here in UCD Business School, Graduate Business School, and how you got connected into to talking to our students a little bit about these issues.
Sure. I've been an adjunct professor since 2016 when I finished up running GECAS. GECAS was actually one of the core sponsors of the MSc program. I knew Patrick Blaney, who was the original program lead and professor. And so that's how I got involved doing lectures each year.
Now, you obviously have many decades experience in aircraft leasing. Was that always an interest of yours? Or was it flying and the travel bug that you hear so much? Or were you coming from it from a different direction?
No, I don't have jet fuel in my veins. I'm not a pilot or anything. I, in fact, sort of fell into aviation. My 44-year business career, the whole focus has been on real asset finance. 30 years in aircraft and aviation, and 10 years in infrastructure and property finance. And so even though I didn't plan on this, my first 5 years were in investment banking. Then I spent 30 years at GE, sort of in my primary career. And then the last 9 years, I've been doing senior advisory board work. And then the last 4 years, I've been CEO of this smaller outfit called Nordic Aviation Capital. That was a big regional lessor that needed restructuring post-COVID. And we sold that to DAE last May. And the way I got into aviation was back when I was a mid-level executive at GE, we had a stake in a company called GPA, which is well-known in Ireland. And we had to sell it for a gain during the Gulf War one. And so one of the things I worked out was doing a share buyback with the company itself so that we could get capital appreciation on our stake and get liquidity. And then as it turns out, a year later, they had a failed IPO, GPA. And so GE came in. I was heavily involved in sort of buying a bunch of assets from GPA and then buying the asset management company, which sort of formed the nucleus of GECAS later on.
Now, did you come across Tony Ryan, of course, the founder of GPA during that period?
Yeah, Dr. Ryan, I got to know as part of the Planes for Share buyback deal way back, and his fellow executives like Jim King, Colin Barrington. These are names of lore, if you will, in the GPA story.
And what was your assessment of Tony Ryan at the time? Because he's an interesting figure on which many biographies have been written.
I found him very colorful and charming. Also, I found what was most interesting to me is that he gave back to the west of Ireland. While he was a successful entrepreneur, and this is pre-Ryanair, right? He always remembered his roots. You know, GPA was Shannon and West Ireland based. He built other things like MRO facility and stuff like that. So he always had sort of a give back to his community headset. So I was very, very impressed by that.
Norm, let's talk a bit more broadly and let's go right into the news of today, because it would be a rather unfair podcast for our listeners if we didn't delve into what's happening out in the Middle East. Now, it's not going to be a particularly political podcast, but it is going to talk about the economic effects of the conflict. We're not allowed to call it a war, but the conflict in Iran and in the general wider area, which is spilled over. We have seen prices of, you know, West Brent crude go up. We have seen prices of WTA go up as well. Jet fuel, obviously reflecting that, some airlines cutting back on routes and cutting back already on capacity as we talk to you. So how damaging for the airline business do you think this particular conflict in the Middle East is going to be?
Well, it very much depends on duration of this whole war. And hopefully it'll be shorter, like everyone has been talking about. But let me just scroll back a bit. I mean, pre-February 28th, the industry, and I'm talking about the aircraft leasing and aviation industry, was in a pretty good space for lessors. Demand was pretty strong, albeit K-shaped. So premium was doing well. Long haul was doing well. Supply of aircraft was pretty tight because of OEM and engine and MRO issues. And so you saw a lot of used aircraft being extended and parts values and things like that going up. You know, capital was pretty plentiful, both at the investment grade level and then asset-backed securities, bank loans. So the market was in a pretty good space. I mean, if this thing ends quickly, I think it can get back to that situation. But if it drags, what you're going to find on the airline side is some of the smaller, weaker carriers will have to restructure or even liquidate. Airlines that are in the oil importing countries, in many cases, it's a matter of like availability. Let's say gas has spiked up 30%. Jet fuel has probably spiked up 100%. So if you're in an oil importing nation, that's quite dire. LCCs in general, if they haven't hedged, they generally have higher percentage of their op expense and fuel. So for the airlines, it's quite a tough situation. It also has impact on passenger demand because, you know, there'll be fuel surcharges. So there'll be some level of demand impact, hopefully not destruction, if you will. If the stock market falls, right? A lot of the premium passengers, we're living off those, that appreciation. There could be impact on the passenger side as well. And long haul as well, because generally people like staying sort of closer to home in these sort of stressful times. You also will see airlines beyond just fuel surcharges, they'll actually bring down capacity. And so you're seeing some of that already. And so that'll impact used aircraft values eventually. You know, you have new order slots as a lessor. Those will be somewhat tougher to place because no one's focused on, you know, 28 slots. They're focused on survival today. On the funding side, the market's still pretty strong, but there's been some spread expansion anywhere from 25 to 75 basis points. So, you know, if this thing is over quick, you can get back to the, you know, strong scenario before. If it drags, you know, all bets are off.
Yeah, and I suppose I'm just looking at a few, before we came on, looking at a few airline share prices, and they all seem to have pretty much the same shape, which is, you know, they're very sleepy COVID, and then they kind of come roaring out of COVID, and it's just remorseless up, up, up. You can see strong income performance, passengers carried is very high, they can't get aircraft. They can't get aircraft slots. They can't get air crew. It's just the post-COVID thing. And now it has dropped back off a little bit from Iran, but not retracing where it was during COVID so far, which kind of fits with what you're saying. So airlines generally have been doing exceptionally well since coming out of those COVID restrictions in most of the Western world anyway. So I suppose what you're saying is this may be only a small interruption to that or longer, depending on how this conflict sort of evolves from here, because they have been doing exceptionally well right across the board.
And airlines, I might add, they've just gone through so much with COVID and other geopolitical events over the years. So they're quite resilient and experienced, most of the management teams. But this, again, is probably the biggest oil shock that you've seen in, ever, probably. So we'll see what happens. But it's going to be pretty rocky if this thing drags.
And talk to our listeners a little bit about hedging. I suppose some listeners might have the idea that airlines kind of lock in their fuel maybe, 2 or 3 years out, so a lot of these things don't come into the real market for quite a while. But a lot of them don't have a lot of fuel hedged.
Back in your backyard, Ryanair, I think, has got very strong hedging for the next couple of years. And then it drops off with some of the other low cost carriers where it's not, 90 or 100%, but it's maybe, 60 or 70%. And then it sort of tails off each year. But in the U.S., there's some carriers, like some of the majors, like United and Delta, they're largely unhedged. If you got some hedging, you have some cost benefits, but there'll still be demand impact on your passenger base.
And why did the U.S. airlines do that? I mean, at the peak of COVID, I think oil was almost zero. I mean, it would have seemed a good opportune moment to lock in.
Well, you normally just go forward a year or two. Okay, so now you're looking at today's world, not and I think there is a general belief that they just price it into fares through surcharges and things like that. Southwest is still had a hedging policy, but some of the majors would rather just push through fares at the time, take the margin in, if you will. Some like Delta, I think Delta still has a refinery actually, so they're. They're benefiting a little bit at the margin from that asset.
Now, you've been running GECAS for many years. What would you be doing now if you had thousands of these planes on runways and in the sky, under lease agreement? Would you be taking particular steps at this moment if you were running the company today to, either protect your own position, et cetera? What would you be doing if you were sitting in that seat now?
Most of the lessor CEOs who run the big shops have been through COVID and, various wars and things like that. And so I think, number one, you just look at your customer base and you sort of do risk assessments of each. Like I talked about smaller carriers, you look at their cash positions, maybe they don't need the capacity. And then you look at other country risk because of currency and things like that. And then you just work region by region through the issues. In general, lessors, we want to work with the customer base. And it's too early to say, there's going to be deferrals and repos and things like that. But everyone just has to be on high watch.
Yeah, and I suppose there's no safe zone in the world because these big lessors, they lease their aircraft out to Asia, Europe, North America, South America. Yeah,
most of the large lessors have exposures in many, many countries.
What do they do in terms of the newer aircraft? So they have a contract with Boeing or Airbus to get new aircraft. Can they sort of say to those suppliers, we don't need them right now, or slow down the orders, or are you just got to take delivery and that's the end of it?
Again, I think that's too premature to say that, they're going to have to defer orders and things like that. I think you've seen some of the airlines who were struggling, they push out slots and give them back earlier slots to lessors, or the OEMs themselves take back the slots and reallocate it themselves. As I said, pre-February 28th, the market was reasonably tight in terms of near-in slots. So I suspect you'll see, if this thing drags for a bit, I think you'll start to see some of that type of activity. Now, the problem is a lessor could take it back because they could place it. Now it's not as clear, but I think it's too early to say, lessor deferrals and, stuff like that. And by the way, in general, you don't cancel from the OEMs like Boeing and Airbus. You just sort of restructure your order.
The other thing I suppose a lot of our listeners will be interested in is the structure of the airline business after this, or if this, as you say, drags a fair bit, maybe drags into the summer months and so on. We have seen in this part of the world, in Europe, you know, big consolidation. You've got sort of Ryanair in the low-cost space with EasyJet. You've got sort of, you know, Lufthansa, you've got Air France, and then you've got IAG, BA. So you've got these three big power blocks, and then you've got the low-cost airlines with one kind of airline predominating, which is Ryanair at the moment. So do you see this as being an opportunity where the structure of the airline business could be change, where it may burn off a few of the smaller competitors who have been burnt off pretty much for quite a while, and those bigger blocks consolidating even further, like a Ryanair or Lufthansa, Air France, one of those groups?
Yeah. Airline consolidation has been a secular trend that's been going on for quite a while. You know, you've seen the U.S. consolidate amongst the major network carriers, and you've also seen like Allegiant merging with Sun Country. There's talk about JetBlue looking for a merger partner. So I think these sort of events sort of accelerate things a bit, but it's part of an ongoing consolidation trend across the world. It's not just North America, but Latin America as well. And then parts of Asia as well.
Yeah, I mean, I suppose if I was Ryanair, I'd be saying to myself, this is going to give me even more, you know, market share. You know, I'm going to be able to drive out the last few competitors. And if I can't drive them out, they'll certainly be weakened. They won't necessarily be able to, you know, kind of expand or slash fares or whatever. Their ability in the market will be limited.
Yeah, he's quite well hedged. But I think many of the smaller carriers that have already gone away. But he should be able to get some share from some of the other leading LCCs.
In terms of airlines more generally, looking at the business, some people will say, you know, it still is a fossil fuel based industry, that we need to do more for alternatives. We need to get the SAF fuel speeded up without those sort of developments. So that perspective would say this kind of I suppose pressure on the business is not necessarily all bad. It may force the airline business into some kind of restructuring and bring certain changes that are merited, the critics of the industry would say, and it should force us onto alternatives such as rail and possibly ferries and just maybe a reduction in the amount of travel we're all doing. What do you say to that perspective, which I suppose has taken a more industry-sized view?
On the sustainability, the industry's made an effort of getting more SAF, but it's very expensive. Their main focus amongst the airlines is getting the latest technology fleet. So like Airbus Neos or Boeing Maxes, which are, 20% more fuel efficient than the old technology. The jet fuel market right now, that's even going to push more people to the new tech. The issue has been on the new tech has been engine issues, powdered metal on the Pratt side, maintenance timing issues on the CFM side. So airlines have been focused, while their intentions are good on sustainability, they also want the airplanes to stay flying for a while. So it's been more balanced than just everything has to be, SAF, because of some of these engine issues. And there'll be a trend to the latest tech. The wide bodies, same thing going on with the pretty much everything's gravitated to 350s and 787s, the latest technology there. In terms of substitution, perhaps there'll be some. I mean, flying, you just can't, you can't substitute long-haul flying with anything else. Short-haul flying, places like China where there's high-speed rail that's quite advanced. That's just been a gradual shift overall. But in general, there's not a lot of easy substitution for aviation other than, select short-haul routes like, London to Paris. You can take the train. But people still fly, but other places, if you want to go to Toulouse, it's not easy. So you have to fly. So there'll be some, it'll probably be people just not flying.
Yeah. That's the substitute.
Versus hopping on, they're not going to hop on a ferry or anything.
I suppose the car is a substitute then, isn't it? I mean, people just go on vacation locally, like staycation.
Yeah, no, exactly. They'll stay, staycation, sort of like COVID days. But, you know, the focus right now is survival, right? But, and the focus will be more on fuel efficient new tech planes. But right now they got to get past the near term.
Now, you also have an interest outside aviation, which is in the whole area of asset finance and infrastructure and capital development and all those sort of areas, which I suppose are less glamorous than the airline business, but probably more important in the long term because they affect all our lives. So tell us a little bit about what has you interested in that area and the kind of trends you're seeing at the moment.
Oh, yeah. I mean, way back when I started, I was more, they called it project finance at the time. It's now called infrastructure finance. And I just think that's a very, let me step back a bit. I mean, and this is more for the student audience. Okay. Aviation is just, it's a wonderful global industry. Okay. So if you're interested in, you know, exploring other countries and stuff like that, aviation is great. You know, everything that impacts the global economy impacts aviation. So it's, you know, whether it's COVID, wars, you know, some Icelandic volcano, everything impacts aviation. The customers are really interesting. Some are, you know, big flag carrier country type operations. Others are entrepreneur. There's a lot of cool technology things going on. So I'm very lucky to have been involved in the industry for many decades. But even before that, I was in project finance. And so this today is, you know, renewables. It's gas pipelines and storage and things like that. What'll be interesting is what's going on with nuclear as well. And it's you know, and it's driven not just by efficiency needs. It's driven by AI. As you know, these data centers are huge users of power. In fact, that's a shortage right now. You can build these things, but it takes forever to connect. And also the grid itself is another interesting space. And so there's also ports and airports and things like that. But the whole energy transition, I think, for students who want to get into the real asset world is also quite a fascinating area as well, especially nuclear. And you know, obviously, world events have put a lot of focus on energy security. It's not just the supply. It's actually you need security, national security. And so that's why I think nuclear will be a very, very interesting space to study. And you know, the renewables area is also very interesting because there needs to be upgrades in battery storage technology as well. So while I started off my career in that area, I'm continuing to study that area, energy transition. I just find it very, very exciting what's going on there.
And Norm, do you think, I mean, obviously years ago or decades ago, most of that finance was just given through conventional banking, the banking channel, and maybe there was bonds raised or whatever, you know, debt finance or whatever. But it's kind of gone into this whole different world now of private credit, and you've got private equity, and you've got all these consortiums, and it's quite hard to get a handle on. And there are stresses showing in the private credit markets and so on. So that whole area has kind of become very changed, and it's very much sort of, some of it's in the shadows. The rest of us don't know much about where all the money is going and who owes what to who or whatever. Am I wrong to form that impression, or is that something at least close to what's going on?
Well, there's a lot of media narrative with what's going on in private credit, you know, software industry specifically. But, you know, data centers are being financed through the private markets, but also through public bond offerings, because you've got these huge hyperscalers who are quite credit worthy, and so they're going to borrow bond. But then also some of these neo firms, you know, they use sort of project financing techniques. So, I mean, I think I could get off on a tangent on private credit, but right now I just think the good news with aviation and these sort of power assets is they're real life hard assets. The market has shifted from, you know, software ARR type of cash flow lending, you know, at least hard assets, you have something that's tangible, and it's actually in quite high demand. In the case of aviation, you have it was maybe not the next few weeks, but it was in very high demand, but it's also a portable asset. No doubt, you know, there's some issues in private credit because it grew so fast. Interest rates went up during the time when, you know, in the early 20s. and people paid up for some of these things. So no doubt there'll be some issues and, you know, more cockroaches, if you will. But I don't think anyone thinks it's systemic right now. But the good news is for the areas that I'm interested in, you know, you've got hard assets backing these loans, not just cash flow hopes.
Yeah, sure. I know the it's old fashioned in that sense that the assets are, you can go and visit them and observe them and see them. You know,
yeah, it's I probably when I was running GECAS, one of the divisions we had was called PK Air Finance, which is now owned by Apollo with a stake by Blackstone. And they're probably the most sizable private credit player right now. And, you know, I think their portfolio is done quite well. There's also technologies of funding, like asset-backed securities, collateralized loan obligations to fund those. And so they've been fairly cutting edge there. So as usual, the bigger players will be fine.
Yeah, I suppose it's probably just deja vu for me and others after when you hear things like securitization and collateralized.
It's the issue, I think, that's, look, there's software issues. Obviously, there's, you know, credit tensions from rates going higher, stuff like that. But I think what's got the public is that there have been these gated redemptions. So some of these structures were sold as semi-liquid, okay? And in reality, loans are not that liquid. And so there's a bit of a, I wouldn't say run on the bank, it's probably too strong. But, you know, if you're a retail investor that hasn't, you know, done lending and stuff, look, and they hear other people are wanting to get out. And if the redemption gate was 5% and everyone's submitting 15%, you probably want to get some liquidity too. And so it's a small chunk of the whole private credit ecosystem, but that's what's getting all the news attention. You know, at the same time, you probably read the Trump administration is allowing 401ks, which are sort of retail funds, to get into private credit. But I think everyone has to be very realistic on the redemption limits and the fact that, yeah, you get a yield premium, but you also have an illiquidity aspect. And so it's a bit of a communication thing. And I don't think anyone's talking about, I'll have your entire net worth in private credit if you're a retail investor. But, you know, you probably should have some percentage if you want to get higher yield in private credit assets. But I would, you know, right now I would go like, hey, I would stick with the hard asset. I don't, software is very, very hard to fathom right now. But I wouldn't have any issues with hard assets.
Yeah, I prefer gold bars, and they're very hard. Listen, before I let you go, because we're up against a time pressure, I know that since you've left the aviation leasing business, you've developed all these other interests, some of which we've discussed today. But you're doing some further study, and you're looking at new areas. So you're a great advertisement for sort of keeping your career relevant and learning new things. So tell us a little bit about that.
You know, I'm actually a student right now studying global transition at the University of London. Just because it's an interest of mine. I'm learning. I'm in Korea right now because my wife is from Korea, and I'm learning Korean as well, so I can speak to my brain.
How's that going?
It's going well, but it's hard to learn a language when you're old. So my granddaughters are probably better Korean speakers than I am.
We'll do next year's podcast in Korean.
Yeah, I won't count on it. But at any rate, I'm doing some academic stuff. I'm still on like a board of this company called GA Telus, which is an MRO sort of aircraft parts firm down in Florida, which is where I live. And then, I'm still teaching at UCD. And then finally, I sort of joined our industry foundation called ISTAT Foundation, which is giving back to sort of aviation communities and also scholarships for young people who want to study aviation. So where I am is in my career, because I did like primary career was GECAS, and then I did sort of a second act running this Nordic Aviation Capital thing, which is taking something out of, you know, bankruptcy and then restructuring and cleaning it up, you know, then selling it. So I'm sort of done with full time, but I still want to, you know, keep engaged. I find my social network is, for better or worse, largely aviation. So doing some of these foundation work, some of the consulting work is keeps me going beyond. But at the same time, I want to go back to old areas I used to know, like global energy. and learn a language, which is pretty tough at my age.
Well, you seem to be doing okay, and it's good to have so many assorted interests, you know. I mean, it's very admirable that you're playing golf, not that there's anything wrong with playing golf.
Yeah, I don't want to be, I don't want to be planning my week around my haircut, you know. I want to have structure. You know, look, at my age, it's a matter of staying healthy as well. So exercising every day, watching calories, intermittent fasting. My daughter's had me doing Pilates right now. Okay. So it's not just sort of mind stuff and social, but it's at the end of the day, it's health.
Yeah, when you put it all together, it makes you pretty busy when you put both your business stuff and your...
And then I also been very active. And I think this is for young people, you know, while you have your day job and all that, but, you know, focus on building your financial portfolio, your net worth. And so I've done that many. I've been a stock market investor. Now, this is not a good week to be one, but I've been a stock investor and property investor for decades. And it just keeps you, you know, in the news and following what's really, really going on.
Yeah.
And so, of course, no one can understand what's going on with this Iran thing. But anyway, at least I can feel the market pulse by, you know, being an investor in many, many shares and also asset properties too.
Maybe take the summer off and we'll all come back in the autumn and see where we're at.
Yeah.
Listen, we have to leave it there for the moment. It's been a fascinating conversation covering a fair bit of different kind of things, which is what we like to see. But for the moment, I really appreciate you coming on to the podcast. That's Norm, Lou. We really do enjoy talking to you.
Okay. Thanks, Emmett.
Now, if you enjoyed this week's episode of the UCD Business Impact Podcast, please subscribe to episodes on Apple Podcast or Spotify. We cover a broad range of topics with insights from business leaders around the world, so there's sure to be something there for everyone. I'd like to thank our production team of Beth Gormley and Mike Liffey. They work tirelessly in the background, sourcing interviewees, editing, promoting episodes, and everything in between. I've been your host, Emmett Oliver, and we hope you can join us next time on UCD Business Impact.